Hey there, thanks for tuning in for another episode with a fantastic, phenomenal, influential, life-changing guest, and that is Dr. Sanja Ardwan. I can't wait for you to hear all the resources, the insights and guidance and lessons learned that she shares with us and how she's encouraging each of us to reflect critically about our social identities and do that ongoing reflection as we do this work in student affairs and higher education. I hope that you're doing well. I hope that you're getting a lot from each of the episodes. If you haven't joined our Patreon community yet, that website is patreon.com/resilientcampus. So we hope to see you there in that community. Until then, I will get out of your way so you can take a listen to this amazing interview with Dr. Sanja Ardwan. Welcome to the Resilient Campus Podcast, amplifying the voices of college inclusion innovators. I'm your host, Sabby Labor, founder and CEO of Resilient Campus. Join me each week as I interview professionals on the front lines of campus and community movement building. For more information, please visit resilientcampus.com/podcast. Episode number 28 of the Resilient Campus Podcast. Today we're speaking with Dr. Sanja Ardwan. Sanja Ardwan, PhD, is an author, learner, educator, and facilitator. Proud of her hometown of Vidrine, Louisiana, and her first-generation college student to PhD journey, Sanja is now a scholar practitioner of higher education. She studies social class identity, college access and success for rural and first-generation college students, student and women's leadership, and career preparation and pathways in higher education and student affairs. You can learn more about Sanja at www.sanjaardwan.com, and that website will be in the show notes. Dr. Ardwan, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm very excited that we can make this conversation happen and that we can get your voice and your work out to our listeners. So thanks so much for being with us today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. Kudos to you for being able to host this podcast and allow people who are kind of doing social justice-based work to share what they're doing, but also to create a community of folks who are really striving for equity in higher ed. So thanks to you for hosting this podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I've heard many great things about you. What do you want people to know about you that are listening today?
Some of it you kind of shared in my bio. I'm a very proud Cajun, right? So I am from a very small town, Louisiana, Vidrine, Louisiana. Doesn't have a zip code, but very proud to be from there. Grew up in a rural working class community. So, education was sometimes valued, sometimes not valued. But I really benefited from having grandparents who lived next door to me, who in a lot of ways, were part of my upbringing, very central to my upbringing. And they really impressed upon me the importance of education to have what they called a quote, better life. And I didn't necessarily know what that meant, but I knew it wasn't what we had. And so, my grandfather always said, if you're going to invest in something, you can invest in your brain because they don't, they can't repossess that. And so it really focused on, getting me an education or at least one that, could give me, propel me to a different kind of opportunity than they might have had themselves. I always credit my grandmother, my mama, to my love of reading and books. And so I didn't necessarily own a lot of books and neither did they, but they were very proud of this set of encyclopedias they did own in their house. But my grandmother really taught me to appreciate the library, and I stayed with her every day in the summer. And she would take me every Monday to the library and challenge me in some ways to get the maximum amount of books. And then I would have to, quote unquote, speed read them, if you will, or at least read them by the time we had to bring them back to the library the next Monday. And so she is really the one that instilled in me kind of my love for reading and my appreciation of books and of the knowledge you can gain from books. So I really credit them as well. My parents were also supportive in kind of my educational journey. And so I really credit a lot of my accomplishments and opportunities to my grandparents and my parents and the teachers that cultivated that for me. I also professionally, I would say I identify as a scholar practitioner. So I spent a number of years as a student affairs educator and practitioner at various institutions, and then shifted over to the faculty about 5 years ago, which I would have never imagined. And my faculty who were in my doctoral program at NC State often said, you're going to be a faculty member. And I frequently said, no chance in hell. And so it's been an interesting interesting process of putting my foot in my mouth all along the way, because I've done everything I said I would never do in my career. And so now I have this interesting place of, you know, having advanced degrees and being a faculty member in a higher education institution, and yet still some of my ways of being and thinking and doing still align with my working class roots. And so I identify in terms of class as being a class traveler. And it's really spurred my kind of work and scholarship around social class identity. So to say all of that to say, I'm proud of my working class, small town, rural roots. And I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to now serve as an educator, specifically in the higher ed space.
That is fantastic. Thank you for sharing all of that. I think that that gives listeners an idea of not only your professional identities, but some of your social identities as well, in terms of like how you're navigating institutions and just navigating our world. So thanks for sharing those things. Tell us more about the work that you're doing today. What is at top of your mind? What projects are you working on, or what projects are you dreaming up at the moment?
Absolutely. And some of that ties back to social identities for me. So, you know, I have identities that are in the kind of underserved or oppressed kind of categories around social class and first-gen status and those sorts of things. And then I have lots of identities that are not. And so, you know, identifying as a cisgender woman and, you know, using the she, her pronouns that align with how people perceive me and all of those things are putting me in the majority. But it's also interesting because other things are coming up for me based on context of life. And so in my faculty role at App State, I'm the new and youngest faculty member by about 20 years. And so that's an interesting space to sit in right now. I'm engaged. I'm about to get married to my partner. And so things around kind of sexuality and being straight and what that means and what that gets me access to that other people don't have access to are really present for me right now as we're kind of in the wedding planning and selection of, you know, readings for, you know, service and all those kinds of things. So all that's coming up for me. But I think the pieces for me in terms of my work that are most salient are really the social class research and working with colleges and universities around recognition of social class identity are really big for me right now. So Dr. Becky Martinez, who is colleague of mine, she's out on the West Coast. She is a social justice consultant and runs her own company called Infinity Martinez Consulting. But she and I have had the privilege and unique opportunity to work on a book for Stylist Publishing. And so we have collaborated with about 24 colleagues from around the United States who represent the undergraduate student space, the graduate student space, early career administrators, mid-career administrators, senior administrators, untenured faculty, tenured faculty, and then folks who have left the field. And they've written their own narratives and stories about what it has been like for them to be an educator in the higher ed space from a poor and working class background. And so Becky and I had the opportunity to kind of write the front end and back end of the book and then work with the folks to put the stories in kind of the middle part. And we're really excited that that is going to be published this spring through Stylist Publishing. We're hoping for a launch at the ACPA and NASPA conferences. But our goal with that book is really to have people start to understand that people's social class stories and social class identity are salient for them and do influence and impact how they experience higher education. And so we're really excited to get that out and to start, you know, doing some facilitation and theory to practice of kind of social class stories and what does it mean to be a class traveler in the academy. So we're really excited about that. I'm still doing some work off of my last book, which was published with Lexington Books. And that was more around college access for rural first-generation working-class students. And so had the opportunity to work with some national organizations as well as colleges and universities around that research and how do we think about rurality and first-generation college students and social class in terms of both college access and success. So that has been important to me as well. So those are some of the major projects. I'm also working on some stuff with some colleagues, Dr. Becky Crandall at Ohio State and Dr. Jeremiah Shin at Boise State around kind of professional preparation and what that means and looks like in higher ed and student affairs.
Yeah, that reminds me of, that's where I know your name actually primarily is that you, I have your book on my shelf around career pathways or the, you know, preparing for your social, student affairs career. And it was recommended to me by Dr. TJ Jurian. And so having that book on my shelf, I was like, I know I've seen Sanja's name somewhere before, other than First Gen and Rural Work. So that definitely is clicking for me right now. One of the things that Aaron Kate, who was on the podcast the last episode in 27, we were talking about how social workers get, you know, coursework and in the classroom and out of the classroom conversations and support and development around what it means to navigate issues of personal trauma in professional spaces as practitioners, as people on the front line. And I had this sort of epiphany, and I don't think I'm the first one to have this, of course, is that there's a lot of that elements of that work in higher education work as social justice educators that we're, I don't know if that's come up in conversations about professional preparation in student affairs roles or in higher education roles as faculty, but that work where we help students and often colleagues to navigate institutions that cause, you know, harm, intentionally or not. Has that come up at all in your work, or am I dreaming up things over here that maybe we're not ready for?
I definitely hear a point, and I think we are definitely seeing, as you know, student protests and challenges with politics and, you know, human dignity in the United States are increasing. And I don't think it's new, right? Like, we saw this in the 60s in the higher ed space. But it's a resurgence, I would call it, right now. And so how do we help people learn about themselves and their own identities, but also how their identities interact with the university environment? If we go back to the history of higher ed, you know, I was teaching this in class the other day about who higher ed was made for. And it wasn't made for a lot of us who are now currently in the higher ed space. And so if institutions were made for the kind of mythical norm of white, Christian, straight, able, affluent white men, then if you are not of those identities, in a lot of ways, universities are trying to unlearn their history so they can better support and be ready to welcome people from other identities. And so I think as we think about preparation, you know, the research we're doing right now is we are interviewing senior student affairs officers, about 20 of them from all around the United States at 2-year and 4-year institutions, to say what do they think our preparation programs are doing well, the early career professionals for the field, and what are they not. And there are some things we thought we would see that are not coming up in the data, but it's a little too early. We are doing an ASH paper on that project, so it's a little early. We haven't done all the data analysis, so I really can't delve into that right now, but I will say that helping early career professionals and graduate students do some self-reflection, self-analysis, but also some critical examination of the culture and context of higher ed is important, because it may help folks make better or more informed choices about where they're choosing to accept jobs. Not to say to only go to places that are ready and welcome for them. I definitely think we should go and disrupt some spaces, but thinking about in terms of emotional and like emotional trauma and triggers and all of those things is to prepare people for what that may mean for them, or how to prepare people to reduce the impact of some of the environmental challenges that we face around isms in higher ed.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. That's fantastic. Yeah. Thanks for bringing us back to sort of the historical context as well, in terms of these issues aren't new. They may seem like a different flavor, you know, essentially within the historical context that we're kind of swimming around in today. I'm obviously sort of thinking very deeply still. So, thank you for sharing that. also, the podcast is not long enough to really truly process how long it takes me to process one thought. So we won't even sit with that too long. Dr. Ardoin, how would you say you arrived to the work that you're doing today? What has that path been like? What has driven you to arrive or to, spend energy and resource in the issues that you are today?
I would say part of it, you know, as a doc student, they talk about if you're doing research or research, which I think is just an interesting debate in general, because I think most people do research that they hold true for some reason, right? They have an interest in because it's their own experience, or it was part of their professional journey, or whatever it may be. And so for me, you know, I explore the identities I hold because I think that there are some gaps in the research, particularly the higher ed research around social class. First, in transformation policy and research is evolving, and it's definitely more than it was, you know, 8 to 10 years ago when I started my own research in that area. And then rurality, we really don't talk about a lot in higher ed, but we are talking about it more now as a result of the election of President Trump. And so I think people are assuming, right, rural people are ignorant, and that's why kind of the U.S. is in the current situation is in terms of politics and just culture and how things are happening. So I think, you know, we can't assume rurality means conservative because that is not true. Rurality also, we make some assumptions, means white, and that is also not always true, right? If we go to states like Texas or California or Arizona, and so, or even places in North Carolina, actually. And so thinking about how do we reframe some of those things? I think for me, it's, again, this combination of I hold some of the identities that I research, but also because there are gaps in the research around those areas. And I think if we're going to understand the kind of complete array of identity dimensions and how they interact with one another, a kind of a multiplicity of identities, then we can't just talk about, you know, some of the big ones, right? We often talk about race. We often talk about gender. We often talk about sexuality, but then not so much maybe the other pieces of one's identity. And so for me, it's elevating that social class conversation to talk about what does that also look like in combination with race or in combination with regionality or those sorts of things. So, or gender. So I think for me, it's been that combination of my own personal identities and interests, but also being able to fill some of the gaps in the research.
Mm, that's wonderful. And I know that you're engaged in, it seems like, a variety of different niche groups, it seems, or niche areas of focus and intention and work, you know, both on the practitioner side, the scholarship side, and then sort of where those roads meet. Where do you find community when you're engaging in this work? Where do you find that today?
Absolutely. So I think for me, one of the first spaces, or two of the first spaces that I really found community around kind of social justice work, one is the leadership organization. I have the privilege to be able to work with that organization. And there are lots of other facilitators in that community, and even people who are not facilitators, who are students who I met through programs and things of that nature, who really both pushed me and supported me in my own development, but also in continuing some of the work that I'm doing. I mentioned Dr. Becky Martinez earlier, who is the co-author on that new book. I met her initially through leadership. And so a lot of those folks, I think, have been instrumental. And then I also had the opportunity to attend the Social Justice Training Institute back in 2010, and then went back again as an intern a few years later, like in 2016. And so thinking about that community, which really pushed me around race, like supremely pushed me, because I was often only thinking about kind of my marginalized identities. And so when I was put in this space that, you know, forced me a lot of ways to think about race, it really expanded my understanding of myself, but also of higher ed in a new and different and broader way. So that has been huge for me too. And then I think there have been communities in professional associations that have been sources of support for me and the kind of work I want to do. NASPA, a few years ago, maybe five, started a new knowledge community called Socioeconomic and Class Issues in Higher Ed, or SEIHE. And I have been able to work with that group in different capacities for a couple of years. And that's really been a space where people are connecting around social class identity, but across other identities. And so that's been a really good community for me as well. And then I have the other social class scholars. So Dave Nguyen, who's at Ohio U, Georgiana Martin, who's at the University of Georgia, Chris DeSoria, who's at Minnesota, Will Barrett, who is emeritus from Indiana State, have all been folks that I've looked at as fellow kind of scholars in the field who have both cited in my own writing, but have also had the opportunity to do some work with as well. So I think it's this combination of scholars and practitioners is where I find community, because I believe that, you know, if we want to be informed researchers, we have to be we have to understand what's happening kind of on the ground in kind of practitioner life as well.
Mm. Dr. Ardoin, Can you share some of those resources that inform the way that you approach your work, the major influences in how you think about the work, whether it's a book, a podcast, or some other body of scholarship?
Absolutely. So I mentioned earlier, my grandmother taught me to love books. And so I always start with books. My partner often jokes that I'm more excited when a book shows up at the front door than when he gets home from work. But, you know, I do love a book. I really do. I would say the thing that really spurred my, even before I knew I was going to study it, I think we got to choose a book when I was a master's at Florida State, to read, kind of in a social justice class. It was a book of our choice. And I picked Bell Hooks, a book called Where We Stand, Class Matters. And it was instrumental, I think, in kind of my early understandings of social class identity for myself, but also for the field. And I always kept going back to that book. I still cite it, actually. I was citing it the other day in a book chapter. And that was really instrumental for me in my beginnings of understanding of social class, particularly through a critical lens. I think everything Bell Hooks writes is good, but that book specifically for me around social class was important. Correspondingly, the same time in my life when I was at Florida State, first read Beverly Tatum's original version of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? So those two books, the Tatum book and the Hooks class book, really, I think, started my journey around being a social justice advocate and researcher as kind of the central points that I can recall as kind of shifting my understanding of identity and kind of what that meant for education specifically. Recently, there are, I would say, four books around social class that were important in shaping my own kind of research questions and the literature I wanted to write. One was Will Barrett's book, it's called Social Class on Campus. It's by Stylus. Krista Soria wrote a book called Blue Collar Scholars, which I've used in courses before. This is a great kind of introduction around what social class means for undergraduate students specifically. And then a non-academic book, Alfred Lubrano wrote a book called Limbo, Blue Collar Roots, White Collar Dreams. And I read it on a plane once, actually on the way to a NASPA in New Orleans, you know, going back to my home state. And it was really an aha book for me because at the time I was having a lot of challenges with a supervisor and I thought it was around gender. And then I read the Lubrano book and I recognized for the first time, this is not about gender. This is about social class. And we're having some classes around our social class identity. And then a model, along with Terriasso's community cultural wealth model, which I've used before in writing, and I know it's not meant to be for social class, but has been in some ways layered with social class identity work. But William Liu has the social class worldview model. Specifically, he wrote a book called Social Class in the Helping Professions, which talks about the revised version of that social class worldview model. And so that has really been shaping my work and my research and my understandings of how to explore social class identity. And then outside of books, there's a podcast called Opportunity Cost, which I haven't listened to a lot of episodes of, but they have a phenomenal playlist on Spotify that's all songs kind of dealing with money and social class, which is interesting. And then an organization which does some amazing work around social class identity is called Class Action. I believe their website is just classism.org. And they do some amazing community-based work around social class identity.
Wow, that is a phenomenal list of resources you just gave us. I had not heard of those four books before, and I have not heard of this podcast or the organization. So you just literally gave me, if not just everyone else on this podcast listening in, six new resources in addition to the ones you already mentioned. So thank you so much for all of those. And I'm going to link those out in the show notes so that people can find the book really easily, find the organization really easily with one click, and then find the podcast as well. So thank you for that. Appreciated.
Maybe one more that's brand new that just came to my mind. So there's a brand new Directions for Student Services volume. It's volume 162. It's called Social Class Identity and Student Affairs. And for folks who need a good primer, it's a short, kind of easier read, or you can just pull the chapters out of that volume, or people should be able to access it for free via their university or local library. So I just want to give a plug to that. The editors of that are Georgiana Martin and Becky Elton.
That's fantastic. I love it. So what you just provided was, if you're already engaged in these conversations, these might be some resources. If you're just starting and you kind of need an entryway, here's some great sort of 101s or primers. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. I'll link that one as well. Now, Dr. Ardoin, let's kind of shift gears a little bit here, because these last couple of questions, they're big questions. But one is, what has been one of the biggest lessons that you've learned in your professional life? And the second related question is, what guidance would you give to people that are listening in to this episode?
Absolutely. So I would say, I've learned a lot from so many people, like from students that I've had the opportunity to work with, from supervisors and colleagues. There are just so many things I feel like I've learned. I think one of the, if I look kind of collectively at the past, how many years? Well, 13, 15, I don't know, between 12 and 15 years of my career, thinking about, I've done everything I said I would never do. And I mentioned that earlier. And so one of the lessons I think for myself, and I don't know if it's going to apply to other people, is never say never, particularly in my career path, because I said I would always live in the Southeast. I moved to Boston. I said I would always work at a public institution. I worked at a private institution. I said I would never be a faculty member, and now I am. And so it's been a really interesting pathway where sometimes I couldn't see my own ability to do something, or I couldn't imagine it because, kind of statistically speaking, nobody in my life had, in my family, had been able to kind of have that opportunity. I think that never say never has been important to me because it has let me, if I would have never gone to the Northeast and worked at Boston University, I would have a more limited understanding of what higher education is. Working at a private institution, a kind of elite institution in the Northeast, kind of where higher ed was birthed, really expanded my understanding of access and success and challenges and stratification and all kinds of pieces to higher ed, which I think made me a better informed teacher and scholar practitioner of the field. So that would be one of my lessons, is that we don't always know what opportunities are going to present themselves, and we don't always know how taking an opportunity and taking that risk will kind of broaden and reshape our perspective on the field of choice for us. So that would be one of them. And then I had a conversation the other day with one of my colleagues at Appalachian State, and I spoke up in a meeting, and I was like, man, you know, as a tenure track faculty member, I said some stuff, and I'm brand new. I've only been there a month. And I was like, I don't know that I should have opened my mouth at this meeting. And afterwards, a tenured faculty member who's been at the university for a number of years said to me, you know, Sandra, if everybody likes you, you're probably doing it wrong. And so I helped in regard. She, Stephanie is a psychologist, counselor type of person. And I thought, you know, you're probably right. And that's probably been right for my entire career. If you surveyed people who worked with me at the varying 6+ institutions I've worked for, there are people who definitely did not like me, and there are other people who really did. And I think that this process of understanding that if we're pushing for some stuff and we are trying to make some changes, that we are going to receive some resistance to that. And that means that some people aren't going to like us or think we're doing the quote unquote right thing, or that we're, you know, to use a term my parents or grandparents would have used, that we're too big for our britches. But so that's, I think, a lesson for me, too, is that not everybody's going to like what I do or what I have to say or how I push. But as long as there are some people who are supportive and in my corner and that I believe what we're doing is going to advance equity, then it's worth not everybody liking me.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing those, both those lessons and those pieces of guidance. I think that people will be drawn to the narrative that you shared, and as well as just to help them connect, like, oh, where did that come from? Never say never. I've heard that in different contexts. What does that mean for you? So I appreciate that you provide some of the context and your own story around that. I was thinking about how when I went to Italy for my my doctoral program had a study abroad component, and we visited some of the earliest institutions in Italy that are built in castles, essentially, right, and are still in castles today in small medieval towns. And that when these towns were built, many of the walls were built with an arc so that when they were invaded by outside forces, that if they were to shoot an arrow at folks that were running through these tunnel ways or through these walkways that the arrow could, you know, could essentially there was barriers. So they couldn't see more than, you know, maybe like 15 or so yards in front of them at any one time, because it was this constant circle, or arc that the walls were, built intentionally. And it reminds me that when we're like setting our vision out for the future, often people propose it as linear, you know, and there's a lot of class things there too, as well, in terms of thinking about who has the opportunity to think about long-term very clearly, and who thinks day-to-day, right, about like survival, food, shelter, paying your electricity bill, et cetera. And it just reminds me of this visual of being in Italy in these tall, rock-enclosed paths that were from medieval times for a particular purpose. And for some reason, when you're explaining some of the connections that you've had around never say never, you never know what's going to happen in your future career, it's like the opportunity to dream out so far. It's very hazy. We only know for certain that change is the constant, right? It's like, so I don't know. I might be babbling, but that's a visual that came to me so clearly when you were mentioning that never say never.
No, but that makes sense, because we're often, like, I especially think when I read, for example, graduate school admissions, personal statements, and they talk about, you know, I want to be this, and they name a specific title in terms of where they want the career trajectory to go. But when I think about it, it's like, well, do you really want to be that? Or do you just see that as, like, you know, the most advantageous in terms of title or money or those kinds of things? And I actually had a student in class the other day. I had them write a paper, and instead of saying, like, where do you want your professional trajectory to go? I said, you know, what really drives you to do this work, and kind of what is your mission or tagline or like those kinds of things in terms of the kind of work you want to do, not the title you might want to have. And so how do we maybe reframe some of that stuff? Because maybe we learn more about what a VC does and realize, you know, I don't want to do all those kind of politics and you know, deal with boards of trustees and all those kinds of things. Like, I just really want to impact kind of equity or student success or, you know, those kinds of things. And you can do that through lots of different avenues. Or I have a colleague, Dr. Jesse Thomas Jr., who from the out has said he wanted to be a university president. We were cohort mates at Florida State and became really good friends. And, you know, he wanted to be in the city of Houston, and he got to Houston, worked at U of H for a while, and then has really, his trajectory switched over to the 2-year sector. And he didn't think it ever would, but he loved the 2-year sector. He loved the impact he's having on students who are attending Lone Star College Prom Ball. And I would offer, I'd put this in the universe, that Jackie will be a university president in the next 5 years. It's just going to be in the 2-year space. So he didn't necessarily imagine the context, but the context has changed for him, but he is still on the trajectory to have that influential position of being a university president, just in a different context.
I love that. And I don't know, you know, I've met so many cool students and people that have an association with Lone Star College. I don't know what that's about. Is it? That's cool. I love that connection. So Dr. Ardoin, as we close out our conversation, I know that folks have already benefited greatly from hearing your insights and the resources that you've shared. How can they add you to their network? What are those ways in which they can do that?
Absolutely. So I'm happy to connect with folks via kind of what I would call traditional social media channels. So LinkedIn and Twitter and all of those sorts of things. They can also find me on my website, which you mentioned earlier. And I will be out and about kind of during conference season. So if folks are going to the SACSA conference in Myrtle Beach in a couple of months, if they're going to the Association of the Study of Higher Ed conference in Tampa in November, at NASPA in LA, or at ACPA in Boston, I will be there in person at those 4 experiences. I'm so happy to chat with people that way. Or they can just email me as well, which is just my name, SandraAudwin@gmail.com.
Wonderful. Okay, folks, you heard it from Dr. Ardoin. She will be at conferences in person for that connection. So look for her sessions that she might be facilitating, and look for, you know, her around the thousands of people that can be at the NASPA and ACPA. But for many of our introverts too, know that there's ways to connect online and kind of have that connection there. So I highly suggest that you connect with each of the guests, and Dr. Ardoin is one of those prime examples of someone that you want to be in conversation with, you want to be in community and in movement building work with. So if I were to give you a call to action, it would be to add Dr. Ardoin to your network today. So Dr. Ardoin, thank you so much for your time, your energy, your brilliance, for taking the time to talk with me and the listeners. Thank you so much for all that you do. It's been wonderful getting to know more about you and more about your work. And so I just wanted to provide deep gratitude to you for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you to you too. Like I said, again, for taking your time and energy and resources to do this podcast. And for all the folks out there who are listening, who are doing any kind of social justice work around any dimension of identity, it is not easy work. It is sometimes thankless and sometimes creates a lot of your own trauma or internalized isms and all those kinds of things. So major love to everybody who is extending their time, effort, energy, knowledge, and experience to making higher ed more equitable and a better place for students, faculty, and staff.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. So I want to close out with an inspirational quote to send all of you back out into that world of ours. The quote comes from Maya Angelou. "We may encounter many defeats, but we must not be defeated." To all those listening in, thank you so much for all that you do. I truly appreciate you. Stay resilient. For ways to support the Resilient Campus podcast and the work that we're doing to build and bridge campus social movements, join our online Patreon community of other social justice educators like yourself to develop connections, get guidance and resources from other folks engaged in this work, and get access to bonus episodes and behind-the-scenes footage that is only available to our Patreon community members. For more information, visit patreon.com/resilientcampus. That is patreon.com/resilientcampus.